Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly interview show where top chess players, authors, content creators, and accomplished amateurs discuss their careers and share stories and chess improvement tips. Perpetual Chess is a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network, and we'd like to give special thanks to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. For more information about the show, you can go to PerpetualChessPod.com. But without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have a double episode for you, a Chennai Chess Olympiad retrospective extravaganza. We are joined by two separate guests who had just returned from Chennai, sharing their experiences. Of course, it's a tournament where so much chess history is written. Legends are born, legends grow, friendships are formed, and FIDE elections take place. In this case, Dvorkovic, the incumbent, won. So we've got two guests relaying their experiences kind of from the opposite ends of the chess experience spectrum. First up is Lula Roberts, aka Lula Robs. Lula has been playing chess for less than 2 years, but she has a remarkable story. She's improved quite quickly, and she's from a small country called Jersey. She's one of the strongest women from the country of Jersey, and they were able to send a team to the Olympiad for the women for the first time. She played first board. It is not an experience Lula took for granted. As you'll hear, she prepared a lot for the tournament. She lived and died with every game, but she also sounds like she was able to sort of soak up the experience and appreciate the experience. So it was great to hear Lula's look back at the Olympiad. Following Lula, we are joined by international master John Donaldson. John attended his 14th Olympiad as the captain of the United States team. The United States, of course, was the favorite in the open section, the highest seed by a significant margin. They had a slightly disappointing result and came in fifth. John discusses that. He also contextualizes the tournament more broadly, having attended so many Olympiads. John also highlighted what he felt to be an underreported aspect of the Chennai Chess Olympiad, which unfortunately was the impact that COVID had on the proceedings. And John is also, of course, just an amazing author and a wealth of chess information. So, and with a special emphasis on Bobby Fischer. So, of course, we always like to get some Bobby Fischer and Boris Spassky nuggets from John. He did not disappoint in that regard. And he also, towards the end of the interview, talks about what else he has been up to. So I'm not going to go through all of the results at the Olympiad. You guys probably have already heard about them. I would say the biggest headlines were from Grandmaster Gukesh from India too. The fact that Uzbekistan won the gold medal, that was a huge upset in the open section. I was quite happy to see that Ukraine won the women's section. But honestly, there's so much that takes place. It's hard to shout out everyone. I mean, I will mention Gukesh, of course, was the biggest story of the tournament, the young Indian grandmaster who had a phenomenal tournament. Over in the women's section, it was great to see legendary grandmaster Pia Kramling win the gold medal for individual performance. Other gold medal individual performances, I'd like to shout out Aliwia Kielbasa of Poland, had an amazing tournament, 9.5 out of 11. And last but not least, friend of the pod, David Howell. When I interviewed him, he mentioned that it's a lifelong goal to win a medal at the Olympiad, and boom, he goes and wins the gold medal for top performance on third board. He actually had the highest performance rating in the entire tournament. And speaking of David Howell, he and Magnus Carlsen just released Grind Like a Grandmaster. You may have heard David mention that too in our recent interview. So shout out to our presenting sponsors, Chessable.com. Be sure to check out Grind Like a Grandmaster, as well as Levon Aronian's got a course out now. So just thanks as always to Chessable. Be sure to check out everything new that they are offering. But without further ado, we're going to get you to these interviews. This is a long episode. There's timestamps in the show description if you need to jump around. But I think both conversations are highly worthwhile, so I hope you all enjoy them as I did. So without further ado, I will talk to you guys in the interviews. And we are here with Lula Roberts. Lula has had a remarkable rise in the chess world. She was a Queen's Gambit convert, got into chess seriously in December of 2020 at the age of 22. She started streaming chess and has quickly reached 10,000 Twitch followers. She has over 14,000 Twitter followers, where she's known as the Meme Queen. And she has rapidly improved at chess in this period, perhaps more importantly. She has a FIDE rating near 1,600. She's originally from a small country called Jersey, or she is from a small country called Jersey, which is one of the Channel Islands off the coast of France. And because this country has a population of about 100,000, she was able to compete in the Women's Olympiad just within 2 years of discovering competitive chess. And she's been doing vlogs for chess.com. Her team Jersey was supported by Chessable and chess.com there. Listeners who heard my mid-Olympiad interview with Mr. Dodgy of Chessable may have heard that he's been coaching Lula some, among others. But without further ado, let's welcome Lula Roberts, aka Lula Robs, to the show. Welcome, Lula.
Hi, Ben. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you. I mean, I've been following you, like a lot of people, online for since not that long after you appeared. And it's been remarkable to see your progress and see you rapidly build an audience. And been taking notes and enjoying. But then especially when you get to go to the Olympiad, I mean, you've probably gotten a sense from having been there and from having talk to other chess players. It's a special opportunity, and you seem to be relishing it, although I know that it's not without its stresses as well. But anyway, Lula, let's begin with when you had a first inkling that you might be able to go to and play in the Olympiad.
Yes. So we started talking about putting together a women's team really almost from the first time I went to my local chess club, basically, because I went just before Christmas last year. They started up again after COVID. And then I went to the AGM, and they were all, you know, we've never had a women's team before. Could we even, like, could that happen? Could we have enough active female players? Because our club is tiny, you know. We don't have that big of a reach. And so, I mean, I had been streaming last year, and I think someone pulled up like the Jersey Chess Federation and was like, Lula, there are no rated female players. You should get involved. You know, you should do this. Maybe you'll get to play some events and stuff. And like this time last year, I hadn't even considered playing an over the board event or getting a FIDE rating or anything like that. It wasn't until the winter that I even thought I might try. But yeah, this kind of February when we were starting thinking, maybe we could put a team together. We need to have a tournament. We need women to play and see kind of where everyone is and who would qualify. It was honestly, it was very hopeful, but honestly, it was kind of touch and go until we got our visas a week before we traveled, or just a couple of days before we traveled to India, because we had to get paper visas. So really, we didn't know we were going until the week before.
Yeah, that's been a common story of the issues with the visa. Considering how many people I've heard that from, I feel like it's been somewhat remarkable how few issues I've heard of people who actually didn't get to go. Now, once you showed up at your club, Lula, obviously you were already building a name in the online space, already getting good at chess. But still, having not even played an OTP tournament when you first heard about it, like, what did you even know about the Olympiad? Did you know that it's, I mean, obviously we all know what the Olympics is. So did you know that it was this like hallowed sort of institution within the chess world?
No, I didn't know anything about the Olympiad, honestly. I mean, after the idea was introduced to me, I kind of figured, oh, kind of like the Olympics, but for chess. But really, right. I didn't know a single thing about it until we considered putting a team together. And then also I read Chess Queens by Jennifer Shahadi, and she talks about the Olympiad in that as well. So really, I was only introduced probably to the idea of the Olympiad a couple of months before it happened, which is kind of crazy to think about. And I do feel incredibly lucky that I got the opportunity to play and put a team together, and that we got sponsored by Chess.com and Chessful, which is kind of crazy in and of itself. All of these things are a bit surreal. But no, it was all very new. Everything is still very new to me.
Yeah. Well, shout out that you didn't just take a picture of yourself with Jen's book, Chess Queens, but you read it. And yeah, that's a good primer for, I know Jen had some formative experiences at Olympiads and yeah, mentioned that like me, who's never been to an Olympiad and certainly never will be, you know, other than as possibly a media member, she like, I think it stirs up nostalgia and FOMO when you're sitting at home sweating this event. And this one in particular, I feel like there was something about it that did just the atmosphere seemed so festive. Now, of course, as we mentioned, I know that it wasn't without its difficulties, but let's bring us there, Lula. So you know you're going. I know you did some training, but let's just get to the trip. So yeah, and this is your third tournament. How was the flight and what were things like upon arriving in Chennai?
Sure. Yeah. So we flew. We were really lucky, actually. I had kind of horror stories of people traveling for like 30 hours plus. We flew almost direct from, I mean, we flew Jersey to London, London to Chennai. It was really easy. We got there, we got to the hotel, and I basically set myself a task to not get jet lagged. So I stayed up for about 2 days straight with like the travel and everything. And I was kind of just a bit like wired on the excitement. And we got there the next day, there was the opening ceremony. And I think we were sat like right in front of the English team, which was really cool because I'd spoken to Zoe, who's on the English women's team, and David Howe, and he introduced himself to me. And it was just like really nice. It was like, oh my gosh, there's all these people from the internet and they exist in real life, you know?
That's amazing. David Howe introduces himself to you.
Yes, it was very funny, actually. No, it was like, it was ironic, obviously, but we're mutuals on Twitter, and he asked me for a picture, and I laughed because obviously lots of people were asking David for a picture. It was very sweet. He was very kind.
Yeah, that seems to be the rap on him. I've certainly had good interactions with David as well. And then, so how many days before the chess tournament started did you get there, Lulu?
We got there just 2 days before. So the day we got there, the day before the opening ceremony, and the opening ceremony was the day before round one.
Okay. Now I've heard mixed reports. Some people said the opening ceremony was beautiful. Others said it might have been a bit long. Where do you come down on this?
Okay, so it was very cool. We saw a lot of cultural displays like dancing and music, but it was very long. it was very long, and we got given this sheet beforehand which gave us like an itinerary and told us that we would be home by like 9 or 9:30. I think we were still waiting for a shuttle bus at like 10 or something. Like, it was a really long day, and it was like for most people, I think the journey from the hotel alone was almost an hour, so it was like a 6-hour experience, which is quite a lot when you've just traveled. But you know, with the level of excitement in India around the Olympiad, it makes sense that it was so like long and packed full of things, because they were just so excited and they wanted to show us everything. And of course, it was kind of, it's a, you know, a once in a lifetime thing. To go. I definitely didn't understand the speeches that were in Tamil, but I did enjoy myself overall.
Good. Okay. And then it's chess time. So yes. What are your expectations? You're playing, I'm guessing mm-hmm. this is your first team tournament
yes.
as well. What kind of prep do you do and what are you expecting as it's time to get down to business?
Okay. So in terms of expectations, I really tried to not set them too high because I'm a bit of a perfectionist. So if I, you know, set myself up for disappointment, it's not going to go very well. I think our team was hoping to get around 50% overall. And I was playing board one, which was a little bit daunting, to be honest. So I didn't really have, I mean, it's always nice to get 50% or more, but I knew that that was quite unlikely to happen, especially if the team started to do well, because I would start facing increasingly difficult opponents. So I tried not to think too much about the results. In terms of prep, we did prep every morning with Mr. Dodgy and with... we had Grandmaster Alonso Zapata, who was our team captain from...
I saw that legend.
Yeah. He's lovely. He was like appointed from FIDE. And so we prepped openings in the mornings before the rounds, essentially. We would wait. You get your player list at 10 a.m. and the round is at 3 p.m. So you have a couple of hours to kind of look them up and see what they play and see if you're happy with it, see if you need something specific, that kind of thing. So it definitely was quite serious. I mean, in terms of opening prep, I always say that I do better without opening prep, to be honest. We did definitely prep for this because it was serious. But in tournaments before, when I've just kind of been winging it a bit because, you know, my last tournament was in Italy and I just kind of wanted to go to the beach kind of thing. This was definitely a much more ordered, like, structured approach. It was serious, you know? It's the Olympiad.
Yeah, and the prep thing's a catch-22. Obviously, the topic has come up a lot here on this podcast, and you'll hear some of my, like, esteemed guests say, you know, you got to try to get that edge, figure out what they're going to play. But then others will say, you need to keep a clear head. You know, you're there.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the work has been done. And, of course, the Olympiad is a unique circumstance in that you have so much time and obviously so many eyeballs on you, which brings me to, you know, when I first reached out to you about this interview, you'd lost, like, your first three games. And you're like, can we wait till we win a game? So
I did ask.
Till I win a game. So I apologize. Apologize for the timing.
No, it's fine. Yeah, the start was really tough for me because obviously with the Swiss, we were pretty much right at the bottom because I was the only rated player on our team. So we got paired against Bolivia in round one and they were just really strong. And I was playing a WFM who was like over 2,000. She went on to beat, you know, a WGM from the England team the next day. So it was like really hard at the start. The pairings were difficult. I mean, obviously it was expected, but it still sucks to lose. Like no matter how much you're expecting to lose, when you get hit by a couple of losses in a row, it really does starts to make you feel maybe like you're doubting yourself or that you should have prepped like better or studied more, that kind of thing. And you don't want to have doubts when you're in a tournament. So that is why I did wait. And I asked you if we could wait until I'd won a game. And I did. I actually won because I had round four off as a rest day and then I won in round five. So it was okay in the end.
Yeah, and you finished, we should say, with 4 out of 10. So you said your kind of stretch goal was 5, right?
Yes. Yeah, it was. So I didn't quite make it, but, you know, I did not, I really didn't do as badly as I thought I could have done on board one.
Yeah. And honestly, like part of the reason I wasn't even on my radar when I reached out to you that you're 0-3 is like, you know, to a lot of chess fans, like just to be there, like it's like you already won.
But sure.
I know that when you're in the heat of the battle as a competitive person, that's why you've made so much progress so quickly. It's obviously it's good to care, you know, and totally.
Yeah, you have to care.
Totally understandable. But we are glad that you turned it around. And what about away from the board, Lula? So obviously you've got your prep in the morning. I know on like Instagram and stuff like that, you mentioned like you went on a little shopping expedition. So you were someone that was like able to escape the hotel. But was it like a lot of downtime, a lot of socializing? I get the impression it was tough for people to coordinate getting together. So basically, like, what would you do after the rounds?
honestly, it was very, very full. And after the rounds, essentially, I had quite a few interviews and things like that at the venue to do whilst I was there. And then we would wait and get the shuttle bus home. Either you would wait for the team or you would go. And we were quite far away from the venue, our hotel. So I think most nights we didn't get home until 8, 9, 10 p.m. We definitely never got home earlier than 8:30, I don't think. So we would have dinner. And then honestly, I don't think we were allowed out after dark. So it was not sociable, to be honest. We did have this thing going in the evenings where Alonso would go over the games from the day. And I did it once. And honestly, I can't do that mid-tournament where you kind of go through all of your, like, nitpick your mistakes. Because I find it also just distracts me. And then I also start doubting myself. So I didn't do so much of that because I just needed to switch off from chess at some point during the day. But yeah, honestly, I mean, they're long games. You have a time control. So there are days, you know, when you wouldn't finish until after 6:30, 7, that kind of thing. So if you need to get back, have dinner, and then, I mean, if your team wants to go over the games, there's not that much free time, to be honest, because you need to sleep as well at some point.
Yeah, that makes sense. But you did escape with a chaperone at least once, right?
I
like
did.
You mentioned you made a friend.
Yes,
so
yes,
what
yes.
Was that like?
So one of the volunteers at a hotel, Sneha, she was lovely and she took really good care of us. We went out shopping together on the rest day. We went into Chennai and did some sightseeing. And the rest day was after round 6, after the Bermuda party. So I did manage to get out.
Okay. And I saw in your vlog, you did attend the Bermuda party, but it seems like you behaved yourself. You were just there for a couple hours.
I did behave myself. I decided, well, honestly, I was very tired. I wanted to get the first bus home, which was at 1 a.m. And then it didn't end up leaving until 2:30 maybe. But I was there for a good amount of time. I saw, you know, everyone that I wanted to see, said hello to them. And I did order a drink. But when I realized at the bar that they weren't measuring the drinks, I decided I just couldn't do. I couldn't do that. I put my drink down and I did not have any alcohol throughout the whole trip actually. So it was very, very sensible. But no, it was good. It was really. It was honestly. It felt kind of like a wedding reception in a way, like the Bermuda party. It was very well organized, you know.
Well, Lula, it shows admirable restraint that you only had one drink, but it is. I'm glad that got to have a little bit of a break. And obviously, we know that you picked up the pace. Your team picked up the pace and won a few rounds. And as we said, you finished with 4 out of 10. You provisionally, I believe, earned the WCM title. Is that right?
Yes, I did, because I had this comeback where I managed to score 3.5 out of 4. So with my 3 losses in the first 3 rounds, that gave me 0.5 out of 7. So I have WCM when I reach 1800.
Okay, well, congratulations.
Thank you. It's quite cool.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it's such a fast rise. It's really cool to see. And I do want to pick your brain about chess improvement a little bit before I let you go. But sure. Before we do that, just you had the big journey back. You've had some time to sort of contextualize it. I saw that you met Judith on the way home. So,
I did.
So like, what are the highlights aside from meeting Judith, which I assume is one of them?
Yes, definitely. Honestly, the highlights for me are probably meeting a lot of the people that I did meet, you know. Like I saw people that I had met in other tournaments, like Anna Kramling, and I met a lot of chess streamers like Jessie February, Rebecca Selkirk, you know, people that I'd known from online that I had never managed to meet up with. It was just really nice because it reminds you that the chess community is a community. And that even though it's an individual game, it really, you know, we are all brought together. And the Olympiad, playing with a team, it's very different experience than I thought maybe than I realized it would be, you know, because when you're playing chess tournaments by yourself, it's, I mean, you're focused on you, but when you're playing at the Olympiad, you're like, oh, maybe I need to draw this so that our team can win the match or draw the match, or, you know, I'm down a piece, but I really need to hold this position. Things like that, that you would, I think it changes your mindset and changes your outlook towards some of the games. And yeah, it's definitely new and very different to tournaments that I'd played before. It is exhausting, though. I mean, it's 11 rounds, and I played all but one. So it was much more intense than other tournaments that I'd played before. So as someone who's still very new to chess, I did feel a little bit out of my depth at times. I mean, I'm not a professional chess player. I'm not a professional athlete. You know, I'm not like, I don't have a lot of, you know, years worth of experience with this kind of stuff. But it was very cool. Of course, it's all still a little bit surreal. I mean, a lot of these things for me don't really sink in until way after they've happened. Like with how fast things go, or a lot of the time it feels like things are moving really slowly, but then you're like, oh wow, I just, you know, played the Olympiad. I don't know. It's, I feel like I need to get distance from things before they sink in.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Well, a couple follow-ups. I mean, number one, did you like the team dynamic as opposed to individual tournaments that you've played in?
I think to an extent, it definitely helps with morale. But I also feel like it adds pressure because, you know, you're not just thinking about your own performance, you know, it's definitely, there are more factors at play than there usually would be. So I think yes, but I think that I am glad that most tournaments are individual.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, and on the topic of your fatigue, you did mention that you had long bus rides, and as the tournament went on, following you on Twitter, I could sense an increasing exasperation with the length of just the time getting to and from the venue, which is totally understandable.
Yeah, I mean, it some days it was a little bit ridiculous when you're kind of, you get on the bus and then you're waiting on the bus for half an hour before it leaves, and right. Then it's like 45 minutes or more journey, so it is kind of a little bit too long. It was resolved at the end, you know, that it did get better, but and I do know that they were trying very hard, but it was definitely tiring, especially after your game, especially if you lose and then you have to wait kind of 45 minutes for a bus or whatever, and you just want to be home and you just want to have your dinner and have a shower, because also it's, you know, it's really hot weather, so it's all just,
yeah, right.
Yeah, it's all just a lot. If you really just don't want to be somewhere, you can't. There's no quick fix.
Yeah. Well, 2024 Olympiad in Budapest, Hungary. I'm guessing if it's really in the city center, which I think it is, I'm guessing the transportation issues would be significantly better because you can probably get there on your own if you need to.
Yeah.
You gonna go if given the opportunity?
If I have the opportunity to go, then yeah, I would love to be a part of it again. I would love to compete again. I definitely feel like I have learned a lot from this first experience. And in 2 years, I don't know how my chess will be. I'm hoping that I will have continued to improve. I would be really interested to see, you know, how differently I play at that Olympiad. I feel like it's an interesting way to check in every 2 years.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that brings us to the topic of chess improvement, because you have made great strides in this less than 2 years that you've been playing chess. So what has your approach been, Lula? Are you like a learn online person? Are you a soft tactics person? What's your preferred method of chess study?
Sure. Honestly, I don't study that much, which I play a lot.
You're not supposed to say that.
I play a lot. I really do. I play all the time, obviously, because I'm streaming. But I think that for me, when I improve the most is when I play classical chess. I think that those are huge learning experiences for me, because I mean, sitting down for 3, 4, 5 hours and just like thinking about a position, I think I learn the most from those experiences. I definitely do need to do more tactics, and I definitely do need to do the chess ball courses that Mr. Dodgy gave me. he sends me messages like, I can, like, he was like, I can see that you haven't been like doing this, you know, like, you need to study. You can't just watch the videos. You know, I feel like, I don't know, I've been getting this increased urge to actually put some time in. I think it's, as you know, as it's closing in on autumn and it starts to get colder, I want to sit in my room with a book and do more things like that, whereas in the summer I really don't. But I think that for me, playing and analyzing is the most important thing. I'm not that, I don't really like studying openings that much, because at my level people still deviate really early. You know, 15, 1600, not everybody knows 20 moves of theory or more. So, yeah, I have a lot of chess books there staring at me right now, which many of which have not been looked at yet.
Sounds like you're a chess player to me. Welcome to the club. but yeah, I mean, and learning by playing is a tried and true method of improving. And obviously it's been working for you. So don't listen to Mr. Dodgy. He doesn't know what he's doing. no, just kidding, Mr. Dodgy. But it has been impressive to see. And I agree with what you about classical chess being the biggest accelerant for myself and a lot of people. Yeah. And I, if you don't mind, I would like to, the subject of the Reykjavik Open comes up fairly often here. I know that you didn't have all positive experiences there, which I would be not happy to hear you talk about, but welcome the opportunity for you to discuss, but also just would like to hear how that experience compared to the Olympiad.
Yes, sure. So Reykjavik was my first ever FIDE-rated tournament, and I went into it with no expectations, really, because I had never done anything like that before. And I do have to say, overall, it was a positive experience. I met a lot of wonderful people. There were definitely negatives that I've spoken about, you know, on Twitter, and there are articles about what happened and things like that. And I don't want to bring it up, you know, all the time, and I don't want to talk about it too much. It's definitely more complicated being a woman in chess than maybe I had thought before I first went to a tournament. And I do feel incredibly privileged entering chess as an adult in that way, that I never had to be a young girl in chess, you know, and feel like maybe not welcome in every space. But the organizers from Reykjavik are all amazing. And I saw, you know, a lot of people on, for example, the Icelandic women's team that I met in Reykjavik. It was honestly so nice to catch up with everyone at the Olympiad. It was very different to the Olympiad. I found the Reykjavik was much more sociable. We had a lot more downtime. Even though there were days with double rounds, we still had more downtime. I mean, we were in an Airbnb, like a 5-10 minute walk from the venue, so we could just kind of come and go, which was very different with the Olympiad, obviously. But I think that as you play more tournaments, you definitely, maybe, I don't know, maybe building stamina is the wrong word, but you don't take the losses as hard. I took losses really, really hard in that tournament. And I felt a lot like I didn't fit in, or that I didn't deserve to be there, because I felt like, you know, I've just joined chess, I'm not even that good yet, what am I doing here? You know, you lose a couple of games. And because it was my first tournament, I didn't have a FIDE rating. I had all this imposter syndrome that I was wrestling with at the time, which is 100% a me problem, but I think it's something that a lot of us face. And I don't have that so much anymore. And I think it is just exposure and a little bit of experience. I'm not saying that I'm experienced, but a little bit of experience does help.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you're getting more comfortable. And yeah, I know that, like you said, it wasn't, unfortunately, you did have some negative experience in Reykjavik, but it sounds like there was some positive as well.
For sure.
And at least on the topic of men making you feel unwelcome, was Chennai better in that regard?
Yes. Yeah. Everybody was incredibly nice. I didn't meet anybody. I didn't meet anybody at the tournament that I had a negative experience with, to be honest. It was really, really nice meeting people from all over the world. And I met lots of captains of lots of different teams. And I would love to see them again at another Olympiad. No, it was good. Yeah.
Great. Glad to hear it. And what do you have coming up, Lula? So I know you mentioned the fall's coming. You're hoping to hit the books. I know you're joining me as you're about to go on vacation. are you thinking about tournaments, and what else do you have planned?
So I have one more tournament that I've booked this year, which is actually the Guernsey Chess Festival. So Guernsey is the Channel Island next to Jersey.
Oh, wow.
So they host a federated tournament, and for example, Harriet Hunt is playing, and some other great British players. So I'm looking forward to that. That's in October, and that's the only other one I have this year. That is four in 1 year, which is 0-4. That's quite a lot for me. I was thinking about playing Hastings, but I don't think I will, because I just think it's too much travel, and I have to leave something for next year. I can't play Reykjavik, the Olympiad, and Hastings all in the same year, because I won't have anything left. I think that now things are going to get a little bit quieter. I'm going to have some more time to study. I've got one more tournament, but other than that, I can focus, on content creation and on improving, and less on, big events, which is super exciting, but it is, I am really looking forward to going away on vacation, but I haven't been at home for more than 2 weeks for quite a while, and it's weird. It is nice to have some downtime.
Yeah, that makes sense. And on the content creation front, obviously you spend a lot of time streaming your, I would hope or think a lot of time brainstorming on Twitter, because you're so good at coming up with funny tweets and memes and stuff. But do you have any other sort of projects that are going to be front and center for you, Lula?
Big projects? Nothing planned. One of my goals for this year was to really work on YouTube, and honestly, I've let it slide. But that's still something I'm thinking about.
Yeah, there's always so many potential, avenues to explore.
Yeah, it's just the time, really. But now that I'm having more time, I do want to do more, because I'm the thing that I love about content creation is that it's very creative. So if I'm not making something, I'm not happy. I feel like stagnant. I feel like I'm not making progress if I'm not creating in some way. So I would love to start doing more YouTube, that kind of thing. Obviously Twitter is something that I do spend a lot of time on, which I hope I can justify in some way. I do spend lots of time streaming. Honestly, I don't have big plans that far in advance, because everything happens so quickly, and I just I'm kind of taking it all as it comes. So I don't really know what's going to happen 6 months from now, which is a little bit scary, because I used to be a bit of a planner, very organized. but now I can't be, so.
Okay. Well, whatever it is, I'm sure we will enjoy it. And Lula, thanks so much for taking the time. I know you've got a big link to in your Twitter, but the main thing is people, I assume, should check you out on Twitch, correct?
Yes, that would be the main thing. I do stream 6 days a week, actually, apart from now I'm going on vacation. But yeah, 6 days a week.
Don't worry. This comes out 6 days from when we're recording. So I don't know. You might be back soon after that. But in any event, encourage listeners to. And you're also on Instagram, we should mention. And I think that about covers it, right?
Yeah. All the social medias.
Yeah. You're a grandmaster. All right. Well, Lula, this has been great. Really appreciate your taking the time. I know things have been hectic for you. So congrats on your success. Looking forward to more. And yeah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our friends at aimchess.com continue to roll out new features all the time. Some of the latest include a training room where you can work on tactics, advantage capitalization, blunder prevention, tons of stuff. They've got their own analysis board. And of course, they still have my favorite feature, which enables you to do large scale review of your games and look for patterns that recur, review the mistakes that you've made in your games, set goals, and the list goes on. Aim Chess is well worth checking out. And if you decide to subscribe, please use the code PERPETUAL30 or use the link in the show description to save 30% on aimchess.com.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
And we are here with a return guest, always one of my favorite guests. He is a chess historian, an award-winning author, particularly an expert of Bobby Fischer and American chess history. And he is the 14-time captain of the American Olympiad team. So has 14 Olympiads to reflect on. And he just returned home, a 27-hour trip from Chennai. He was there captaining the American team, as always. And we are excited to welcome back International Master John Donaldson to the show. Hi, John.
Hi.
So excited to have you as always, John. As I mentioned in email, of course, we are both Americans, so we were hoping for slightly higher than a fifth place finish from the U.S., and we'll discuss that eventually. But first, John, I'd just like, if you don't mind, to hear you compare this trip to some of your others. What was different about it? What was memorable about this epic trip to Chennai?
Well, I mean, the first thing is it's by far the longest journey I've ever undertaken in my life. There's no direct flights in the United States to Chennai, so I ended up traveling on the way over. I flew on Qatar Airways, and I stopped in Doha, and that was like about 16 hours, and then it was another 4 hours to Chennai, and when you factor in the layover and the airport time at both ends, yeah, about 27 hours. And then on the way home, I went through via Singapore and then, you know, sort of circled the globe, if you will. There's no way that such a journey is going to be very comfortable, but it was for a good cause. I mean, you know, the Chess Olympiad hadn't been held since 2018. And although COVID is still with us, FIDE decided to go ahead with the event, and the Indians very generously decided to step in. Of course, the Chess Olympiad originally was supposed to be held in 2020 in Minsk in Belarus, and later that fell through, and then it was moved to Ханты-Мансийск in Russia, and then that fell through, and then it was moved to Moscow, and it was all, you know, earlier this year it was, you know, the thought was going to be that they were going to hold it there this summer, but obviously for reasons that everybody in the world's aware of, that no longer became an option. And then it very much looked like the Chess Olympiad would not be held this year. I mean, it was 4 months to go before the event, and the Indians accomplished the seemingly undoable and managed to put on the event.
Yeah, and from what I've heard so far, I did a couple interviews that some listeners will have heard with people in Chennai, Grandmaster Axel Bachmann and Mr. Dodgy of Chessable. They were pretty overall constructive about the conditions, and that tended to be what I heard in terms of interviews I watched and social media stuff. John, how was your experience just sort of from a lifestyle in Chennai perspective?
Well, the first thing I would say is that going into the Olympiad, you know, there's a fair amount of work usually that has to be done, but this was more than normal. Of course, one condition was that all the players needed to get visas. And for some, that was easier than it was for others. And some players on our team didn't get visas until, you know, the last week before they were going to fly. So that was a little disconcerting, but it came through. And that was sort of emblematic of all the sort of organization, because we didn't know what hotel we would be staying in until about a week before. And literally when we got on the plane, we didn't know if we would be met by anybody. But once we arrived, everything fell through, came through in perfect shape. Literally when you got off the plane, there was like a crowd to greet you, and people took you through customs, and they helped you collect your bags, and they were just a huge team of volunteers that, you know, there must have been like, I don't know, 500 young Indian chess players who volunteered 2 weeks of their time to help to make the Olympiad run more smoothly. And for example, when the fellow that I was, Parham, the fellow I was associated with, he was the one that met me at the airport. You know, was very, he was peppering me nonstop with, how can I improve my chess? I mean, it seems like, you know, definitely, you know, there was a huge enthusiasm for chess in India. And so I think that looking at how the organizers performed in terms of the, you know, the things that are most important, like the playing hall, is it comfortable for the players? Is there enough room? They got high marks for that. You know, were the hotels comfortable? I think, you know, obviously not all the players stayed in the same hotel, so there could be some differences on how people might, you know, look at it. But in general, I think they would get high marks again. You know, another question is like, how easy is it to get to the playing venue? You know, in some past Olympiads, some teams had to travel like 30 minutes or an hour to get to the playing venue. Here, that wasn't the case. My impression, it was more like nobody had to travel more than about 15 minutes. So for all those things, I think they get really high marks. The things that maybe they don't get so high marks on are things that they couldn't control at all. And one of those was the weather, and another was the situation with COVID. And with the weather, you know, for people that, you know, follow it in Fahrenheit, it was like, it was in the 90s most of the tournament. And, you know, there were a couple days where it rained and it cooled off a bit, but it was pretty hot. But to be fair, probably no hotter than it would be like, you know, on the Eastern Seaboard in the summertime. It was very humid, but again, you know, in a lot of places in the U.S., it can be pretty humid. So personally, coming from Northern California, I found the heat a bit oppressive, but you can't control things like that. The situation with COVID was rather interesting because, of course, some of the newest variants have come from India, and there are like huge number of cases there. So the requirement was that all players be vaccinated, but that could be very loose. It could be you had one shot or you had two vaccinations and two boosters. You know, it was pretty minimal what would require you'd be called vaccinated. If you weren't vaccinated, you had to show a proof of a negative test. Now, going into the Olympiad, there were questions about how FIDE would address it. Would they mandate masking? Would they allow spectators? And initially, the ruling was there would be no spectators in the event. And of course, that was a big disappointment for Indian chess fans. But it was thought for the players, you know, health that, you know, that you know, just, you know, it would be, because there's no way you could really police the people that were coming in as spectators as to their status. But it turned out in the end that the spectators were allowed, and it turned out also that the FIDE decided that there would not be any masking mandate. It would be voluntary. And I would say probably no more than about 5% of the people were masked at any time. I would also say that there were no, like, you know, protective barriers or anything like that. So why do I mention this? Well, I think first off, when you talk about this Olympiad, you know, the first story that comes to mind is just how magnificently some of the young teams did. You know, Uzbekistan, India too. You know, just really performed, you know, well above, you know, everybody knew that they were good. They knew that they were going to have a great result, but they obviously exceeded expectations. But it wasn't just young teams. For example, the Armenian team played extremely well. And this was a veteran team. I mean, these were players that were like in their mid-20s and older. There were no like young superstars. Having said that, these three teams were probably not even close to being the biggest overachieving team in the Olympiad. That had to be Moldova. They finished tied for fourth through sixth, albeit a distant sixth on tiebreak. But if you look at that team, they had one grandmaster. They had no players rated over 2,500 FIDE. Their board four was rated below 2,400 FIDE. Judging, I don't know the exact ages of the team, but I would say they look to me like they were mostly like in their early 20s to mid 20s. I could be wrong about that, but they certainly didn't look like young the way the Uzbeks and the Indian teams did. And yet that team, they beat Norway, they beat a lot of great teams, and they performed, you know, they must have picked up well over 100 rating points. So I would say that all these teams that performed well are really to be commended. The teams that did poorly or well below expectation, I think the situation is a little more complicated. And that brings me back to the earlier topic of COVID, which doesn't seem to be like mentioned by any of the other like, you know, YouTube videos I've seen. By the way, there's a very good one with on Chess India with Ivan Sokolov, the captain of the Uzbek team. And it's over an hour, but I would say if any of your listeners have a chance, it's well worth listening to. He has a lot of interesting insights, but he doesn't really mention this. And I suspect the reason why is because it just wasn't a factor for his team. And that, you know, all of the players for the Uzbek team were healthy. But for a lot of other teams, that definitely wasn't the case. And I can't tell you with certainty, but when I look at like the performance, for example, of Norway, Norway was seeded third, albeit, you know, a lot of their power, shall we say, was concentrated in just one single player, Magnus Carlsen. But they ended up finishing, I think, about 50th, behind Zimbabwe and behind South Africa. Not probably the exact result that they were hoping for going in. And if you look at the players besides Magnus, they collectively shed, the other four players, about 75 ELO points, which, you know, considering that, you know, Magnus played pretty much almost every game, that means their other players played like maybe 8 games average, maybe 9 games average. That's a huge number of points to drop, just a huge number of points to drop. And I mean, I don't know for a fact, but I could strongly suspect that, you know, at a certain point, some of the players on their team were maybe not at 100%. And the policy from the tournament organizers was essentially don't ask, don't tell. And what I mean by that is there were daily temperature checks, but if you didn't want to, you could easily avoid getting checked. And even if you did get checked, you know, for a lot of people, when they test, if they have COVID, their temperature is not going to be abnormally high. And in this case, I think unless you're like, you know, in triple digits, you know, and close to about to die, the organizers were not going to, you know, take any action. And the reason for that, for both sides, why they didn't, even if they had COVID, they wouldn't report it, is because one, if you were a player, you would no longer be able to play. And two, you would be having to face like a 2-week quarantine in India. Yeah, on the other side of the coin, I would guess that if they had done a COVID test and everybody that was positive during the Olympiad, like say in round 10, they tested, they would have had to shut down the event. If they made the decision that if you were positive, you couldn't play. So for our team, I can tell you, first off, not to, you know, in his case, it's pretty well known, but Levon Aronin, he was sicker than a dog for much of the event. And he could have been like sick the whole event, but he never really had a high temperature. So, you know, it was kind of like more like a mild cold or flu, but it got progressively worse. And by the time he played the match against Greece, he still felt well enough to play. But when he was playing, he was just like, he just had like a brain fog, and he just wasn't available to play the last, you know, the last games. So he's one example of a player who definitely his result was impacted by that. Wesley was ill early on, but he managed to recover. Carissa Yip, she was very sick at the beginning of the tournament. Don't know that she had COVID. And in the case of Levon, he didn't have COVID, but he had something that required the tournament doctor to give him antibiotics.
Wow.
You know, I think the combination of the heat, different food, combination of factors led a certain number of players to being ill. And I think in that case, you know, having younger players in your team was definitely advantageous. But I do mention that only in the sense that I think all the teams that played really well deserve a lot of credit. But some of the teams that maybe did worse than you would expect, I would cut them a little bit of a break, because I think they were probably, their players were not at 100%.
That's interesting. And I do feel like, as you said, I do feel like that was underreported. I followed the tournament very closely and didn't hear too much discussion. So I have a few follow-ups from all of that information you just laid on us, John. And the first one is, like, in sports, you know, it's kind of like a common thing that when someone's injured, you know, they're kind of discouraged from talking about it because it can be perceived as an excuse. So do you think there was some of that at work with players not discussing it, or was it more like fear of the event being sort of, thrown off track by a lot of people saying that they're sick?
Well, if you actually reported the tournament doctor and they did a test, and, you know, and many teams came with COVID tests, so they would have known the status of their players. But if you actually officially notified the tournament organizer, I don't even know what would have happened if you had two players that tested positive for COVID. Would you not be able to field a team? I don't know. As far as I know, there were no teams that were unable to complete the event. I think that also the prospect of, like, you know, near the end of the event, you know, having to stay like in, you know, an Indian hotel or some hospital or something for 2 weeks, I don't think that was facing that prospect, I think most people would probably just, you know, put on an N95 mask and just gut it out and get on the plane and get home.
Yeah, that makes sense. And a couple other follow-ups, John. Number one, I did want to clarify the commute time. There were teams that had to travel over an hour. When I interviewed Axel Bachmann from Paraguay, he mentioned that. And I know that Tallulah Roberts, who will be on this episode, she on social media was growing increasingly frustrated with the wait times and the shuttle buses. Again, I do overall echo what people have said about the quality of the organization, especially considering the short notice, but did want to mention that. And I wanted to follow up about, you could avoid a temperature check if you wanted. So how would someone avoid one?
Well, the temperature checks were usually set up outside of the dining area. Okay. And you could just arrange that when you exited the dining area, if you just exited with several other people, and then they would just take the first person out the door, and then the other ones would just take a right-hand turn, and off they'd be gone.
Okay.
So Well, there's nothing tricky about it.
Gotcha. And one other point of interest, when you did make this long journey, did you travel with anyone from the team, or was it just you?
It was just myself, and I'm afraid that was the case with many American players, for the simple reason that, one, we don't all live in the same location, and two, a lot of the players were coming from different events. Not everybody had to travel on the American team for a long distance. For example, Wesley and Linier came from Zagreb, where they, you know, they had been playing in the Blitz tournament there. And so for them, it was more like about, you know, 12 or 14 hours. It wasn't 24 hours. I think Levon came from Armenia, but most of the players came from the U.S. And particularly the longest journeys were the people like Tatev, and who played for the women's team, and Alejandro, who was the coach for the women's team. They traveled from the middle of the U.S. and that made it even longer, you know, because you had that additional travel time inside the U.S. to get to another place. Yeah, so it was pretty brutal, but. You know, to be fair, I mean, probably, I mean, you know, think about it, you know, Indian players always have to travel, but usually they don't travel to the U.S. They usually travel to Europe, and that's not so bad. That's kind of like the midpoint for everybody. It's, you know, 10 to 12 hours.
Yeah, and Grandmaster Robert Hess was there coaching, and I believe he came from India, at least, like, probably not a long time in India, but I think he mentioned on Twitter that he attended another event elsewhere in India just prior to the Olympiad.
Right. There was a match between I forget who was playing. They were playing, and Robert was one of the commentators for that match. So he had traveled from, I don't know whether he was in Europe or New York, but he had traveled to another city, maybe it was Mumbai or someplace, and he had done the work there, and then he came from there. So in general, I would say that, you know, for a 12-hour time zone difference, you'd want to arrive, you know, maybe a week early. Most of the U.S. players arrived like 2 to 3 days early, but I think, you know, with people's really busy schedules these days, that, you know, is pretty much, you know, you're not going to do much better than that. And the one disadvantage was that our team started slow. And, you know, in the first round against Angola, we really struggled. We won eventually 3.5, but even there, it was a kind of a harbinger of bad things to come, because Levon, he was lost in the position where the Angolan, you know, player agreed to a draw. And in the second round, we really struggled to win against Paraguay, 2.5, 1.5. And the thing about the Olympiad scoring, it's by match points, but game points greatly influence the second tiebreak, which is essentially the teams that you face and the number of points they score in the event multiplied by the number of points that you scored against them. So if a team finishes with like 16 match points, you multiply that, I believe, by the number of points you scored against them. So if they scored 16 and you scored 3 against them, you get 48 points. So obviously scoring 2.5 against Paraguay, a team that, you know, didn't finish, you know, super high up in the standings, that, you know, while other teams were scoring 3.5 or 4, really put us behind on the secondary tiebreak. And the tiebreaks become more and more important in these Olympiads, because the number of rounds in Olympiads has shrunk. It used to be, you know, when I started out, it was like 14, then it was 13, and now it's down to 11, which is pretty much probably the minimum you could have. And the number of teams has increased greatly. This one had close to 190. So when you add those two factors in, number of rounds increasing, decreasing, and the number of teams competing increasing, obviously you're going to have a tighter squeeze, if you will, amongst the top scorers. And you saw that here. I mean, there were two teams finishing on 19 and one team finishing on 18. You know, and for example, we were probably, you know, we had very good chances if Wesley converted to win in the last round, and we would have finished on 18, the same score as India too, but we would have been a distant fourth on tiebreak. You know, for us to have won bronze in the last round, we had to win the match. Plus, we had to hope that one of the three teams that was ahead of us would actually, you know, draw or lose their match. And then that didn't turn out to be the case.
Yeah, a little bit disappointing. But yeah, your explanation of the conditions and, yeah, the tiebreaks do matter, and it is shorter than ever. Now, some people have said that they feel like now there's just too many teams. Are you of the opinion that there needs to be some sort of like threshold for teams to compete in the Olympiad, or do you say the more the merrier, John?
I would say for the Olympiad, it is sort of the more the merrier. I mean, for example, in the regular Olympics, you know, like in track and field, they have like minimum qualifying standards and things like that. But in chess, I think the idea is that this, especially for some of the countries that don't have so many opportunities, this is like their one chance every 2 years to get some international competition. And, you know, so I think that, you know, it is what it is. It's, you know, obviously it would be better if there were a few more rounds, but with so many teams, it's quite expensive to organize the event. And I should mention that the federations pay for their players to travel to India. The organizer doesn't cover that cost, although FIDE covered the travel costs of many of the less economically privileged countries. There might have been like, I don't know, maybe say 30 countries that got some sort of subsidies all the way to free travel. The U.S. Chess Federation, of course, covered the cost for our players. But the food and hotel, for the most part, is underwritten by the organizers. There's a formula. It's like each team gets like three double rooms. So the federations that are, you know, wealthier, like the U.S. or most European countries, they upgrade and make sure that all of their, they pay a premium so that all of their players are able to stay in single rooms. I mean, it's quite a long event and the players are older. So, you know, it's pretty much essential. But still, you can imagine, you know, just making the event every day that it's held, there's quite an expense incurred. So there's an incentive to try to keep the event, you know, the number of days that it runs, you know, under control. And so I don't see the Olympiad becoming, you know, more rounds, even though that would be one possible solution to the situation that they have at the present where, you know, teams really get bunched up in scoring.
Yeah, and generally, regular listeners will know I'm a proponent of tie breaks over the board, but I do think that in the team element and with the cumulative score, as you described, the tiebreak system, I think it's decent because at least teams know going in, and there is kind of more data involved in the tiebreak than there is in an individual competition when you are adding the combined scores of all the people. But anyway, I mean, as you say, I know it's an imperfect, there's no perfect answer when you don't have an unlimited budget. Now, John, one thing I think listeners might be curious about as a captain in the Olympiad is what your day-to-day is like there. Could you just walk us through a tip like round four? You wake up and tell us what happens through the course of an Olympiad day.
Sure. So the first thing that happens is that you need to submit the, to back up a little bit, the round has ended the previous evening. Say around approximately 8 o'clock. It varies, but you know, somewhere around that. By 9 o'clock, pretty much all the games of the round have finished. By 10 o'clock in the evening, the organizers have made the pairings for the next round. And then the teams have until the next morning. You know, it could vary from Olympiad, but usually by like 9 or 10 o'clock, you have to submit your lineup. And of course, one thing that's changed since over the last dozen years or so is it used to be that there were four regular players and two reserves in the open competition, and there were three women and one reserve in the women's competition. But at a certain point in the late, maybe 2008 or so, they changed it. And or maybe it was 2010, I'm not sure precisely when, and they made it so that each open and women's has four regular players and one reserve each. They equalized it out, which seemed quite reasonable. So what that means for the captain, though, is his job sort of got somewhat easier, because now instead of having to consider two reserves that might play in addition to the other four, there's just one reserve. And so you know, different teams have different ways of handling that. Some teams just play their first four all the time. And that was traditionally the case with the Armenian team in the days of when Levon Aronian played top board for them. Other teams like the U.S., which have traditionally been more balanced, try to use all five players. And generally, the game plan is, you know, you play everybody the first half of the tournament, and then you try to gauge who's in you know, good form and who's not, and then go from there. But of course, with only one reserve, sometimes it can just be the process of elimination. Somebody's lost a terrible game, or somebody's really sick. You know, things like that can mean that there's really no deep thought involved at all. You know, you just have to do what you have to do. And then you, a little bit after 10 o'clock in the morning, you know, the lineup of the other team. And then this is where Robert would step in. You know, he had worked some in the evening before, especially some teams he could pretty much guess who the first four players would be, or at least maybe say who the first three would be. But then after that, then it's a question of the players preparing for their individual games. And that was one thing that that's really changed a lot over the last couple decades. It used to be in the old days that what you were looking for in a hotel was, you know, it should be clean, it should be quiet, and preferably you should be able to walk to the venue from the place where you're staying. And, you know, if it checked all those boxes, you had a really good location. Here, there's a new factor involved the last couple Olympiads, and that is having a strong, secure internet connection. And that was a problem in the hotel we were staying at. And I should mention, by the way, that India and India 2 were staying at the same hotel we were. And so it wasn't like, you know, we were staying, I would assume, in what was considered to be one of the best hotel options available. But with so many players today, you know, using cloud-based preparation, they really sort of feel vulnerable if they don't have, you know, an internet connection. And so we were finally able to get it, pin it down and get some mobile hotspots for the players. But one thing I came away really impressed from this event with was the ability of the Indian bureaucracy to provide jobs for large numbers of its citizens. Because, you know, it was amazing just for something like, you know, a mobile hotspot. You just go in the U.S., you just go into, a store, you just pick it up and you'd set it up and it'd be done. But here, you know, you had to bring your passport and they actually had to take a photo of you to be able to get this, because it was like considered like a security issue. I'll spare your listeners, but it was a small form of torture that was it was very pleasant when it was resolved. You know, that was probably the only real problem with the other thing. Looking back at this, wherever you're going to have the Olympiad, you know, food is always a question, and you know, with buffet. It doesn't matter how good the hotel is. After a certain period of time, you know, the it seems like the meals are coming back faster and faster. The same ones, you know, day after day. You know, it's just impossible to keep things fresh. Not physically fresh, but just, you know, something new and that you're looking forward to eating. The one thing that made Chennai a little bit different than other Olympiads is, you know, if you're staying in, for example, the next Olympiads in Budapest, if you're staying in downtown Budapest, if you don't like the food in the buffet, you can just go out and eat in a restaurant. You know, it's not an issue. Here, you know, if you were a tourist and you were there for a couple weeks, and if you got, you know, Montezuma's revenge, it wouldn't be a big deal. But if you're playing in the tournament and you're playing for your country and your teammates and you have to be more responsible, venturing out of the hotel really was not an option. So to that extent, you know, I know that some of the players like Sam Shanklin, you know, he just, you know, he wanted a burger or a steak, you know, and this was not going to happen. So, you know, but, you know, I mean, what are you going to do?
Yeah, that makes sense. But and this has come up again on the prior podcast discussing the Olympiad. I'm still a little hazy on, so was there just no place to walk? Or, I mean, I know that I understand that there were like handlers that discouraged people from leaving the hotel, but it does seem to me from the outside looking in, like if someone really wanted to go to a restaurant, they could go to one.
Oh, sure you could. But I mean, I think the question is, a question of different, bacterial flora,
right,
to put it delicately. Okay, I mean, I'm sure that when Indians come to North America, their stomachs feel, a little sensitive. You know, I mean, just because in different places, there are different microbes, and so yes, I mean, we were strongly discouraged from going outside to eat in a hotel because the hotel we were staying at was like this, four-star Indian Radisson Blue, where they probably had, very, very careful in their hygienic practices.
Right. Okay. Let's get back to the day in the life, John. So.
Sure. Certainly. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So you get.
Yeah. You don't want to concentrate on, meditating on the throne. I hear you.
Exactly. So you post the lineup, which, as you said, in this particular Olympiad, there often was very little thinking involved based on who's available. And what happens next? I mean, is it mostly just waiting around?
Well, from 10 o'clock to about 2 o'clock, the players are preparing for the games and then getting a little bit to eat, somewhere in that time frame. And then around 2:15, they're walking to the central meetup point where the bus takes us to the venue, which, so maybe by the time, you need to budget about 25 minutes between you leave your room and you get to the playing venue. And then you would get out. And I should mention that the security was very tight. They did not allow anybody to take any vehicle into the playing area. The area surrounding the playing area. Only official buses and cars were allowed in. And so then we would get out.
Okay.
And then
we back up for one second, John?
Sure.
So were the players ever preparing together, or was it generally they were preparing on their own? And how was Grandmaster Hess involved in it?
Okay, sure. So one thing you might, reading what Sokolov, listened to what he had to say about the event, and I'm sure that his viewpoint was probably seconded by a lot of other players and observers. There was a lot of sort of talk that the U.S. team was like just like this, all-star team of mercenaries, if you will, and that it wasn't a real team. It wasn't like a tight-knit group the way, like, say, like the Armenian teams are noted to be. But I would say this, compared to 2016 and 2018, this was probably a tighter team than those ones were. Certainly the team meetings were longer and more involved, and people talked about different openings and games they'd played, and part of that, I think, just because LeVon's a very social person and very engaging, and he sort of took on the role of like the team leader. I would say the team spirit was pretty good. As far as the preparation went with Robert, I think it really depended on who was playing that day and also who they were playing. And, in some cases, players were, pretty clear about what they thought, pretty high probability, what sort of opening would appear on the board. And maybe they would need some help from Robert. Other times, they knew what they played. I mean, after all, these guys are like, world-class players, and they would just spend, just be themselves. But there was definitely a communication amongst the various team members on different openings and things like that. So the team, didn't perform to expectation, but it wasn't because of bad, mojo on it.
Okay. And did they prepare? I mean, obviously, these are professionals, often with their own teams helping them prepare for their games. Was there much sort of interfacing amongst the players in terms of like when they would prep for individual players?
It kind of just varied. You know, certainly the players during the team meetings, they would discuss certain openings, and they would discuss, if they knew something about the people they were going to play against, they would share common experience, that sort of thing. But in general, a lot of the preparation that's done today, it's just individual preparation that's cloud-based, and, the Silicon Oracle is the ultimate arbiter.
Yeah, things have changed for sure. In terms of like a typical day, are there any other, you go to the hall when they're playing, right?
You go to the hall when they're playing, and you typically arrive, there was no zero tolerance, but you had to be there within 15 minutes of the start of the game. And, at first we were getting there like at 2:30, but it was kind of a long wait to sit there. I should also mention that, when you arrived on the bus and the point where you actually sat down in the playing hall, it could very much vary how long it would take you, because a lot of it depended on the Indian chess fans. They just loved, they knew all their all the heroes. They seemed to know every American player by face, and they were very much wanted autographs and selfies and stuff. And for example, Sam Shanklin was very popular. I would say that every round he must have been signing 20 or 30 autographs.
Wow.
Coming and going. Yeah, it was I would imagine these players sign more autographs there than they usually do in a year.
Man, that's yeah.
Right, but on the other hand, it was kind of mind blowing to see some of the pictures of Magnus when he would finish his game, and then he would just literally be swarmed by all these Indian chess fans that wanted to take selfies with them, and they were all without masks on. He was out without a mask. I definitely was impressed. I think Viking blood still runs through his veins, because that must have been like his protection. Because if there was anything to be caught, we would have thought he would have caught it there.
Right. Well, I know he's had COVID at least once, although these days lots of people are getting it more than once. Fascinating stuff. So, Jed, we've got a couple other topics I want to hit besides the Olympiad. So, in closing, how do you think you'll look back on this years down the road? It sounds like the COVID and, of course, as you mentioned, the young superstars, the Gukeshes and Abdusatarovs, those will be the first things top of mind for you?
Probably. But the thing that there's a couple of other things I would mention. And one is, let's say that we had won the last round. We would have finished with 18 match points. And how many match points do you think we had in Batumi in 2018?
19?
No, we had 18 points there.
I should have guessed.
So if we had won, we would have finished with the same number of match points against pretty similar opposition. To be fair, in 2018, we played against China, who was missing in this Olympiad. But here we played against both India and India 2. India 2, as great as these young players are, I wouldn't necessarily say they would be as good as the Chinese team. And looking at the, what would have happened if China and Russia had played, obviously it's impossible to say. The only thing I'm pretty certain of is the individual scoring of the teams would have been lower. And that is, this time two teams finished with 19 and one team finished with 18. And I suspect that if China and Russia were playing, those scores would have been a little lower, maybe 1 point lower, for example. And I base that on the fact that over the last few rounds, the top teams, to a certain extent, they kind of ran out of opponents. Not to say the Spanish team and the Dutch team weren't quality teams, which obviously they are, but somehow in this event, they really were not playing like to their full potential. And I think that, with the China or Russia facing them in one of the, penultimate or final round, it would have made for a little bit lower scoring. And I think, either one of those teams could easily have finished on the podium, but still all the more power to the three teams that medaled. And also all the more power to the U.S. women. I mean, I mentioned how, you know, the U.S. Open team, you know, even though it suffered miserably, and I would not have said the performance was all satisfactory, it wasn't that far from actually, you know, even going to the last round, if we'd won and had a little bit of luck, we would have been on the podium. So was it a bad result? Yes. Was it a truly awful stinker of all time result? No, I don't think it was. But obviously we can do better.
Yeah.
But our women really rose to the occasion. They had a really slow start to the tournament, and I explained, you know, Carissa was sick for one, and it's quite possible one of the other players wasn't feeling too well either. But once she got better, you know, I think she won like her last five or six games. They really caught on fire, and all the players in the team really contributed to a great result. Begum, who's playing on board one, even though she was the lowest rated player on the team, that turned out to be an inspired choice by Melik Kachian, the longtime U.S. women's team captain. She was undefeated on board one. She played really, really well. And, you know, she's just a real good leader for the team. If they had scored a half point more against the Indian team in the last round, they would have taken bronze. As it was, I think they lost by like six tiebreak points, you know, out of like 350 to 356, something like that. It was extremely close. And if you look at it historically, the U.S. women finished second in 2004 with, you know, led by Susan Polgar. 2008, they finished third. And here they tied, they finished fourth. Again, you know, China and Russia, two very strong women's teams, maybe arguably even stronger than their open competition teams, were missing, but still, it was a very good result. And it also led to a very interesting performance. Everybody knows about, you know, you take first in the Open Olympiad, you take first in the Women's Olympiad, but there's also a third award that's out there for grabs, and that's the Gaprindishvili Cup. And that's for the highest scoring team in both combined scoring. And that was won by India. That is the India 1 team and the India 1 women's team. But the U.S. was second. Our combined score for our men and our women was put us in second for the Gaprindishvili Cup. And that's the best result we've ever had, ever. Period. And, you know, that, of course, is in, you know, the women get a lot of credit for that. That's one of the reasons why I finished so high up. Yeah, I mean, I think it was, you know, this was only the second time in Dubai, if you want to say that, that's Middle East, but the only other Asian site was Manila 92. So it was good that the Olympiad went to Chennai. In a perfect world, you know, it would be a post-COVID world, and you would be able to have like, you know, 10,000 Indian spectators at the event or something, you know, wild. But still, it was, you know, it was nice they were able to hold the tournament, and knock on wood, there was nobody that got, you know, any long-term serious illness as a result of playing in the event.
Right, yeah, and this certainly won't be the last we see of major events in India, given their chess trajectory, so maybe it can happen again. Now, one more quick Olympiad question, John. Of course, as you mentioned, there's been a lot of discussion over the years and recently online about the fact that some players have emigrated to the U.S., some more recently than others, and are competing on the Olympiad team. Obviously, part of that is due to the investment of Rex Singfeld and the St. Louis Chess Club of supporting some of these emigres like Dominguez and Aronian more recently. So I'm curious, and you can choose to not answer this if you would like, but do you have any sort of debriefing with St. Louis or with Mr. Singfeld after the tournament or during the tournament?
Oh, no. This the Olympiad, I mean, at first, I mean, just to back up a step, the U.S. Chess, they're the ones that are involved with the selection of the team. And unlike many other countries where there's a committee that selects the players, here it's done by a rating formula. And the formula is a very simple one. There are three parts to it. One is at the time of invitation, their FIDE rating. At the time of invitation, their U.S. CF rating. And the third component is an average of their peak USCF and peak FIDE over the last 12 months. So the team is selected by a mathematical formula. Once it's selected, the players vote for who they wish to have as captain and who they wish to have as coach. St. Louis, you know, helps sponsor the Olympiad team. The Kasparov Chess Foundation also helps sponsor the team. But it's the USCF that sets up all the, you know, they sets up the regulations, how the team's chosen and how the coach and captain are chosen.
Right. But nonetheless, without St. Louis, that some of these players wouldn't live in the U.S.
Yes. I mean, you know, I know that one question is, you know, obviously there's only 5 spots for the Olympiad team, and we have so many good world-class players now. I would guess that we must have a dozen players, for example, if not more now, in the top 100 in the world. Because besides the 5 that played here, of course, we have Hikaru, makes 6. And then we've got Jeffrey and Hans and Sam Sevillon and Ray Robson and Dario Swears. That's 5 plus Nakamura, 6 plus the 5 I mentioned. That's 11 right there. There are all over 2650 that are rated in the top 100. So clearly, we, you know, if the Chess Olympiad were ever held in the U.S., we could easily field more than one team that could compete for medals. And by the way, this is not the first time that a team that was not the major team from a country has won a medal in Olympiad. Because in 94, the Russian 2 team led by Alexander Morozevich, which was a young base team also, they also medaled. They took 3rd. You know, Kasparov's team took 1st. What I would say, and also another thing to keep in mind is that, you know, you can't just come to the country and the next year you're playing for the U.S. If you look at, for example, Lenier Dominguez, he had to step out several years and essentially didn't play hardly any chess, and, you know, I think for at least 2 years before he was eligible to represent the U.S. It's a tricky question, but, you know, the United States is a different country than most in the world in the sense that it's not based on ethnicity, but on, you know, ideas of, you know, what it is to be an American. And so we're a nation of immigrants. On the other hand, it's really tough if you're trying to fight for a spot on the Olympiad team and you get so close and it feels like, you know, your hands just reached up on the last rung of the ladder and you're about on the team. And then all of a sudden somebody comes and kicks you down that ladder. So it's very, very tricky situation. But I mean, what I would say is that compared to most other countries in the world that I'm aware of, the U.S. system is very transparent. Yeah. You know what the formula is. There's no special committee. There's nobody hiding behind the veil that chooses the team. It's by rating, and you know what you have to do to get on the team.
Yeah, that's a fair point. All right. Well, on the Olympiad, John, we'll leave it there. Thanks for all your insights. And because we do have a couple listener questions related to Bobby Fischer, I would encourage anyone who has not heard my prior interviews with John to listen to those. We talk tons of Fischer, and John just probably is the leading expert in the world on Mr. Fischer. And I strongly recommend, as I have before, that you read Bobby Fischer and His World amongst John's other Fischer books. So to get to the question, John, the first one is from the official brain correspondent of Perpetual Chess, Christopher Chabrie, who asks if you have any plans of publishing a printed version of your compilation of all of Fischer's annotations and writings. He mentions that it would be a nice companion volume to Bobby Fischer and His World.
It's funny you should mention that, because I do, and it's about 99% done.
Oh, great.
And it's greatly expanded from the ebook. So hopefully that will be out by the end of the year. That's my hope.
Excellent. And one other Fischer question, which is from Jeff Martinson. And I'm putting you on the spot here, John, but I bet you'll remember this story. Jeff asks, can John elaborate on the Bobby Fischer anecdote that when young, he was known to shout "Bobby kill" during blitz games?
I remember reading that. I think in Alan Kaufman used to have a column about Chess in New York that was written when Chess Life was a newspaper back in, it was in that format up until about 1960 or so, at the end of 1960. And Kaufman, in his column, he would capture some of Bobby's favorite kibitzes, if you will, and that was one of them. But that, I think that, you know, that was when Bobby was like, you know, he's like maybe 12 or 13 years old. Oh, okay. Obviously, you know, later Bobby didn't you know, use that as his normal kibitz.
Okay. And so you mentioned that this Fisher compilation should be out by the end of the year. What else have you been up to, John?
Well, I've been working on that. And I've also been doing a lot of work for the World Chess Hall of Fame on their upcoming exhibition on, that's based on the Fisher-Spassky match, you know, 50-year anniversary, but it's much, much more. Anybody that's been to St. Louis and been to the World Chess Hall of Fame will know that they have three different floors where they host exhibitions. And the traditional format has been one exhibition, one floor, but they... World Chess Hall of Fame's breaking with tradition here, and all three floors of the World Chess Hall of Fame will be dedicated to this exhibition, which opens on August 18th, in just a couple days from now. And it will cover not only the Fisher-Spassky match, but it will cover the life of both Fisher and Spassky from their, you know, from their youth all the way up until, you know, in the case of Fisher, the end of his life, and in the case of Spassky, the very end game of his life.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. Opening in time for the Sinkfield Cup. So yeah, more reasons than ever to go to St. Louis, something I still haven't done. might have to look at some flights when we finish this interview.
Yeah. You know, this exhibition should be really, really great. And some things I can tell you that I learned that I didn't know previous to this. One funny thing is that I believe, but I'm not certain, that Fisher and Spassky competed at something besides chess in 1992. I haven't been able to 100% confirm it, but I've seen some indications it was true. Okay, they played tennis together, and one of the things that became very apparent to me in helping to research this exhibition is how both of them growing up, how important sports were for them. And Spassky, one thing I didn't realize was the World Chess Hall of Fame curator Emily Allred and her associate Nicole Tesmer, the registrar there, they managed to unearth a picture of Spassky high jumping. And when he was like in, you know, high school, he jumped his height, which was like 1.78 meters, which is about like 5'10". So he wasn't, you know, it wasn't like going to be a world-class high jumper, but still, you know, I bet you for world chess champions, he might've been the high jump champion of all the world chess champions. So a little piece of trivia for Boris Spassky chess fans.
That's good. And yeah, good to know. And Spassky, I've heard vague rumors that his health isn't great. Do you know of anyone who's been in touch with him and setting up this exhibit?
Unfortunately, in 2006, he was in San Francisco and he was a guest of the Mechanics Institute, and he did all sorts of things while he was there. He gave a simul. He did a training seminar with the U.S. Chess League team for the mechanics. He did a question and answer and reminiscence one day. But at the very end of it, he was feeling tired, and he started to slur some of his words a little, but just for a short time. But about 15 minutes after the last event at the mechanics, he suffered a stroke, and it was very fortunate that Dr. Anthony Sadie was staying in the same hotel with him and immediately diagnosed what the problem was and got him to a hospital. And for stroke victims, that's getting prompt care is really, really critical. And so it was a very mild stroke. Didn't have any impact on his mental or physical faculties. He felt like he was ready to go home like the day after, but they kept him for observation for about a week in San Francisco. But then he did go home and just went back to resuming his normal activities. I saw him at the Olympiad in Dresden in 2008, and he was in good form. But a few years after that, he had a stroke in Russia. And this was a very serious one. And my understanding is that, you know, it left him paralyzed on one side of his body. But thankfully, it didn't diminish his mind. And now he lives in Moscow, and he, I think his last public appearance in the West was about 2015. I think he took the train from Moscow to Berlin, and he was a guest at some chess event. But he's not been seen. I think maybe, you know, he's made some public outings in Russia, but of course now with the political situation, I'm not sure that we'll ever see him. You know, I mean, he was born in 1937, so he's, you know, he's 85 years old. So, you know, hopefully he's doing well, but of course there were also some questions about why he ended up living in Russia instead of, you know, Paris, where he had spent, you know, from 1975 till maybe 2012. You know, why did he make that move over? And that's a complicated question. There's some evidence to suggest that he was sort of taken against his will. And, you know, I, talking to people that whose reputation I trust, I think there's a lot that suggests that was indeed the case. Yes.
Who would have taken him?
Well, you remember he had this other stroke, so he was receiving care. So there's a representative, some representatives of the Russian government, and there was one woman in particular that was kind of like his, you know, became sort of his minder in Russia, and she might have. I mean, you can read about it on the internet if you read what the family members have written and what his sister has written. It suggests that, you know, he was, you know, kind of coerced or duped in kind of coming to Moscow. The other side of the coin is they'll say that, you know, they were making these allegations that his family was trying to steal all of his valuables and things like that. I would believe his family more strongly.
Okay.
In this case, yeah. But I mean, you know, people can read up on it and try to piece together as best they can.
Okay. And last topic, John. So we know we really appreciate your taking the time, coming off this 27-hour flight, heading to St. Louis in a couple of days. But looking beyond, so 2023 and beyond, do you know what your next project will be, or will your much rumored OTB return take place? Will anything else going on?
Well, I would like to start playing more. I mean, I had hoped I would be already playing this year, but just there was a lot of things to do. I've got a couple other small things I'm working on. I'm helping for a new helping Jeremy Silman on his new edition of the Pal Benko book that he wrote, that it was appeared about 20 years ago. So just helping out a little bit in that regard. But just to close, I would say, looking at U.S. chess in general in the year 2022, the Olympiad performance accepted, I think that the chess situation here is a really positive one. And of course, everybody's really mentioning, you know, the great success of the Indian and Uzbek grandmasters, and, you know, how they have all these really great young players. But I would also point out that we have a lot of really good young players, and we have several players. I mean, Hans Niemann, and you know, is 18 years old, and he's almost 2,700. And you know, Sam Sevillon and Ray Robson and Jeffrey Zhang are a little bit older. But Jeffrey's not that much older, and Sam also not that much older. But I have a feeling these guys also can still improve greatly. And the U.S. Championship that will be held this fall will be 14 players instead of 12, and should be, you know, not sure about Hikaru because, you know, he's busy, really busy with his streaming. But most, if not all, the best players in the U.S. Mm-hmm. will be playing. And so that tournament should be a real treat. And I think for a lot of these players I just mentioned, it will be a real battle royale as they try to displace, you know, the guys that are above them. So I see U.S. chess in a very good place right now. And also the number of good young female players in the U.S. has just really improved dramatically the last decade. If you were to look like 10 years ago, there were no U.S. young women on the top girls under 21 list in the world, and now I think there's like 8 or 9 players. So it's definitely things have changed. And you mentioned that, you know, part of it's the sink field effect, but I think also U.S. chess has done a good job in like encouraging a lot of people to step forward and make their own contributions, whether it's like Greg Trahati with his U.S. Chess School, or it's what's going on in Charlotte, or the, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, or you know, around the world, around the U.S. I'm not mentioning all the key contributors, but it just seems like there's a lot of people that are doing a lot of good things for American chess right now. There's a lot of really good chess teachers that are out there, and so I think that going forward, you know, 2023 and onwards, I think that, you know, there's U.S. chess, the prospects are quite bright.
Strong agree, yeah. And congrats once again to the U.S. women on their strong showing. And I think that's a good note to end on, John. John, I always learn so much from talking to you. So really appreciate your taking the time, as always.
Okay, well, thank you for having me. And I'll end on one last note. I would say, I would also congratulate Melek Kachin, the coach for the women's team,
yes.
And also the captain and the coach was Alejandro Ramirez. They both did a really great job.
Yeah, and I have a great interview with Melek deep in the archives if anyone goes digging. I think it was 2016 or 2017, but he's someone I'd like to speak to again sometime. Okay, take care, John. Thank you.
Okay, you too. Bye. Take care.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, Beneficial1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, and or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on the next episode.
Podcast Network.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.